But, you know, we're hanging on to July by a thread, and so let's not hurry it through. But we're in our seventh week on the book of Ecclesiastes, and it's a book that was written in the Old Testament by King Solomon. Now, many of you may not know, but Solomon wrote three books in the Old Testament. When he was young and hopelessly in love, he penned the book, Song of Solomon. We've done two studies on that book here on Wednesday night over the last year. Outstanding studies on that book about love and marriage. He also wrote Proverbs during the middle years of his life when God was really exalting every endeavor that he put his hands to. And then Ecclesiastes, which we are studying, was written when he was much older and very empty. He had discovered, after living for all the things of this world, that they did not satisfy. And so he writes this all down for us in this book. And as many feel, and I do as well, that he maintained his greatest wisdom for the book of Ecclesiastes. We've looked at things in this teaching of Solomon, practical side of the point of life, where true happiness is. Solomon teaches us about why God allows the good and the bad times in life, why life's unfair. He talks a little bit about what happens after death and how we connect with a God we can't see. I mean, he's touching on a rapid fire all throughout this book, these tough questions in life, and he really addresses them. And actually, in some places, from one chapter to the next, to the next, to the next, he just kind of moves in and out of them. Well, this morning, we're going to answer another tough question that many of us probably wouldn't admit to, but the truth be known, does in fact impact us greatly, and that is our money. And we want to look this morning on how much money is enough. And it's no sin, let me just say this to begin, to be rich. But wealth is not neutral. Jesus is the one who said you cannot serve both God and money. And why did Jesus say that? Well, he personified money as a rival God that vies with God for man's attention. Now, Solomon's theme as it relates to finances or money can best be summed up, I think, by this quote from one of the English authors that I love. Not C.S. Lewis is one of mine, but the other one is G.K. Chesterton. And G.K. once said that to be clever enough to get a great deal of money, one must be stupid enough to want it. That's really Solomon's theme here that he learned in his life from wisdom. And having said that, I want you to know we're going to look at two sides of this equation of wealth, our pursuit thereof, what it really does to us, and we're going to look at a very practical side. And that's part of teaching of God's Word. It always has a practical implication to your life. That's why we always teach from an application base, because God's messages are meant to change our life. They're meant to take us from one direction and aim us in another, or if we're going the right direction, to solidify and to impassion us to stay in that direction. And what that does is when you start to listen to God and you start to go the way God wants, now you're operating on spiritual principles for your life, not just living out the practical side, but literally walking in obedience to what the Creator's design is. Why? Because he wants to control you like a robot? No, quite the opposite. He gave you free will with the express purpose of you learning to choose good things for your life. So that's what this is about today. We're going to really look at some practical aspects of things that Solomon saw in his lifetime. Now, Solomon would be the first to admit that he was stupid enough to want wealth at one time in his life. He would tell you he was the head of that list. In fact, his reputation as a wealthy ruler extended far and wide. Queen Sheba, who is an actual figure from history, she came all the way from Ethiopia to Israel to meet him. I can't even imagine how long that trip took. But in 1 Kings, we're given an account of that meeting. It says, when Sheba saw the palace that Solomon had built, the temple of God was also there, she was breathless. She was also amazed at the food on his tables, the organization of his officials, their splendid clothing. She exclaimed to the king, "Everything I heard in my country about your achievement and wisdom is true. I didn't believe it until I arrived here and saw it with my own eyes. Truly, I had not heard the half of it. Your wisdom and prosperity are far greater than what I was told." As a result of her encounter and listening to Solomon's wisdom, which was just something to behold, how he just was able to reason through difficult discussions, and he could talk about a lot of different things. It says she gave him a gift of 9,000 pounds of gold, some $35 million worth of gold, not to mention spices and stones. And it said each year, Solomon, part of his wealth, received about 25 tons of gold This did not include the traditional additional revenue he received from merchants and traders, the kings of Arabia, and the governors of the land. And so, you know, here she was, Sheba, visiting him. She sees this. She goes, it's not half of what I heard out there. So probably for us from the pages of Scripture, it's probably 1/8 of what we could even imagine his wealth was like and the splendor of his kingdom at that time, this even being 3,000 years ago. But Solomon himself would come to you this morning, and he really has to tell you what he would say is the rest of the story. He was probably the richest man in the world then or now. And this is the bottom line of what Solomon practically wants to communicate to you. It has great spiritual implications. But practically what he wants you to understand is that wealth and its accumulation is not a worthy goal in life. That's what he's going to come to you and tell you. And we may say, well, wealth is not my goal either. Well, let's find out. How much money is enough? Solomon asked that question about 3,000 years ago. In fact, he said, so what is the advantage of wealth? You know, why do we find wealth so desirable? Why do we want more money? I bet in a room this size that most of us at one time or another would have to admit we've thought what it would be like and what we could do if we just hit the lottery. We've thought that, right? Or if we just made a little more dough. Why do we always want more money? And I'll tell you what. The number one reason is we believe it will bring us more satisfaction. Even if we delude ourselves by saying, well, I would give most of it away, that would make me feel better. It's still about satisfaction. But listen to what Solomon writes here in the beginning. Those who love money will never have enough. What he's saying, and this is an important principle about human beings. This is an important principle about what we have to struggle with in our flesh as human beings. This is part of this innate wiring in us that's fallen, that isn't right. And here's what it is. Write this down, because I had to go look it up for somebody after the service, because he kept saying, what was that two-word thing you said? And I don't know. I said 25,000 words this morning. But here it is. Those who love money will never have enough. Why is that? Because your yearning power will always exceed your earning power. You will always have a tendency to yearn for more than what you can earn, even if you had all that Solomon had. And that's why Solomon says there on the bottom of that verse, it is absurd to think that wealth brings true happiness. Now, I just read that for you. You can see it on the screen. It is the word of God from the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 5, verse 10. And we go, yeah. And you know what? We walk out these doors and we go right back into thinking, if I only had, if I only had, if I only had, I'll be more happy. And Solomon says, it is absurd to think that way. And besides, the Beatles already told us in 1964 that money can't buy you love. So, what else do you need? All we need is love. That's right. The love of Jesus. I want to give you some quotes. You're going to see some quotes of some very famous and rich people, both from the past and in the present. This gentleman lived over 150 years ago. His name is William Vanderbilt. He was a railroad tycoon. In fact, he ended up building, self-made man, he ended up building, owning and building all these railroads when railroads were the mode of transportation in the United States. And he was wealthy beyond wealth. He's probably one of the first great, great wealthy men in America. And William Vanderbilt says, the care of my fortune is too great a load for any brain to or back to bear. It's enough to kill anyone. There is no pleasure in it. Don't be fooled by the fact that he said this 150 years ago and it doesn't have relevance in your life today. What was true then is true now. There's nothing new under the sun, Solomon would say. He goes, listen to me. You know, just because I had a lot of, oh, it's because I had a lot of wealth, I wasn't happy. No, any wealth, any chase or pursuit thereof, he goes, there is no pleasure in it. Was it John Paul Getty said he would give away all his wealth for one decent marriage? And there were a lot of women that took him up on that offer. You know, and I think we all know this. I mean, we've heard this enough in messages, but and in our own hearts and minds. But lurking somewhere beneath the surface in my heart is this powerful draw to indulge to one degree or another in what Solomon would call the absurdity of thinking that a little bit more is going to make me happy or happier. Now, there's another side to wealth that we have to be aware of that's part of this whole satisfaction thing. And Solomon, who also wrote the book of Proverbs in the middle of his life, said wealth makes many friends. You think? We might think that's a good thing. Yeah, I'm going to have friends. Well, let me tell you about friends that come from wealth. When Muhammad Ali was at the height of his boxing career, he bankrolled an entourage of over 150 people. Literally, 150 people's lives were contingent upon his bankroll to travel the world, literally, and to go to boxing camps up in the mountains and just, you know, part of the whole Ali aura. Well, where are they now? You know, he has one friend left from that whole crowd from the 60s and 70s, Howard Bingham. Now, Howard happens to be an author, a photographer, a producer, writer, and a Christian. Interestingly enough, out of all his friends, he's the only one around, and Ali trusts him with his very life. And so he hung out, not because of the money, but because he truly has an affection for Muhammad. And the rest are long gone. Why are they long gone? Because the money well dried up. Now, I want to take a practical look at why more is never enough. Even though you think it's going to bring you increased satisfaction, Solomon says that's absurd to think that way. Now, let's look why it's not never enough, because Solomon tells us three ways that money and the accumulation of wealth or the desire and the pursuit of wealth really brings more harm to your life. The first is it brings more heartaches or more headaches, more worries. He says people who work hard sleep well, whether they eat little or much, but the rich are always worrying and seldom get a good night's sleep. Now, my early years of labor was by the sweat of my brow. When I was 10 years old, I began to deliver newspapers, and in fact, my route was up to 105 to 110 papers, and so on Wednesdays, I could hardly hold the bags up, and I had to go back twice to do that, to finish my route. I learned at a young age, boy, what it was to have to work. And then I graduated at the age of 13 to push a mower and mow lawns. Push a mower. Push mower, you know. Brrr. And as my son say, yeah, uphill too, right, Dad? Sometimes. At 17, I began a career in the restaurant business, beginning as a dishwasher, and I moved up to a busboy. At 19, I went to work at Todd Shipyards in the L.A. Harbor, no longer exists, one of the many industries that left America. I enrolled in night courses to go to college at that time in my life. And when I would come home from work, to half hour to work, half hour back, 8.5 hours there, so what are that, you know, 9.5 hour day. Then I'd come home, grab a bite to eat, go off to school for 2 or 3 hours, come home, grab another bite to eat, do homework for an hour or two, and I'd go to bed. And I never suffered from insomnia. Out till that alarm went off in the morning. I do suffer from insomnia, though, now. Why? Because I'm not a working man anymore. I am a thinking man, and thinking men wake up in the middle of the night thinking. Oh, it drives me nuts, this fitful sleep I've had. You know, and it also, I almost feel like a wimp when I shake guys that are actually out working for a living, and I shake their hands, and I can feel their calluses, you know, and I feel like the back of a baby's butt, you know. It's just like, I used to be a man. You know, but it's true. Now, I don't have insomnia because I got money. Don't make that jump, that conclusion. I have insomnia because I have to think about things, and it just pops in my head in the middle of the night. What work did I leave undone? Who did I forget to call? Are all the bases covered for the necessary items in my life? I know for some of you who are in the business world, what's my competitor out there doing to beat me back? But Solomon, bottom line, says wealth brings worries. Now, let me tell you something else. This is something I've learned just in the last decade. Have you discovered how much time things cost you? As you get older, time becomes your most valuable commodity, without a doubt. You know, when you're younger, you're just like, let's get all the toys, let's have fun. You know, as you get older, you're like, I don't want to put this away again. I don't want to clean this. Oh, I got to change the oil on that. You know, you have to wash them, wax them, fix them, and keep them going. And then you have to insure them in case they're stolen. Listen, you remember Ross Perot? Ran for president when Clinton and Bush and then Clinton and the other Dole were running. And I loved Ross. You know, he was about 5'7", and he had ears that were 5'6". And he was just a down-home good old boy with a bazillion dollars, right? Listen to this. It's one of my favorite quotes of his. Guys, just remember. If you get real lucky, if you make a lot of money, you're going to go out and buy a lot of stuff. It's going to break. You got the biggest and fanciest mansion in the world. It has central air. It's got a pool. Just think of all the pumps that are going to go out. Or to go to a yacht base in any place in the world. Nobody's smiling. I'll tell you why. Something broke that morning. Generator's out. Microwave doesn't work. Things just don't mean happiness. I mean, you can just hear him. That's how he talks. Yeah. Don't applaud the performance. Listen to the wisdom from the guy who knows. I mean, he had all the money in the world. In fact, somebody just told me yesterday they were in Bermuda. I forgot this at 9 o'clock, so you get a little special side light here. They were in Bermuda, and they saw this beautiful cigar boat blasting across the crystal clear waters of Bermuda. And they ended up, the driver of their sailboat knew the driver on the boat, and they got to talk to him. And they find out that the guy didn't own the boat. He was the caretaker for Ross Perot's cigar boat in Bermuda. And we all looked at each other as he was telling me the story. I go, guess who really enjoyed the boat? Yeah, I just blew 50 gallons of gas. Yeah, it's a rough job. Right? Those are the jobs you want in life, not the ones making money. Okay. John D. Rockefeller. Don't let the time, again, one of the richest guys of his time, and all the Rockefellers preceded him. He says, I've made millions. Listen to what these people are telling you. He's telling us from the grave, but they have brought me no happiness. And he goes, I'd barter them all for the days I sat on an office stool and counted myself rich on $3 a week. You know what he's saying to you? One of the richest men who ever lived in America, relatively speaking, is saying, look it, you guys are just working your everyday job. I'd give up everything I had, all these bazillions, these mansions, and everything I got, just to go back and be that contented person that was in that everyday job. Henry Ford, Ford Motor Company. I was happier when I was doing a mechanic's job. Solomon wants us to know that riches have a price. With worldly success comes worldly responsibility. I'll tell you, this is a concentrated form of what wealth does to you. This is a six-day story of super concentrated wealth thrown into a human being's life. It's the story of Joey Coyle. The movie Money for Nothing was the ironic title of a film that told the story of his recovery of $1.2 million that had spilled out of the back of an armored truck. Joey was an unemployed South Philly longshoreman. And it seemed him and two friends were driving along in February of 1981. Boom, the doors swing open, these bags fall out. They retrieve these unmarked bills, and they started spending them freely. Joey's in a South Philly neighborhood handing $100 bills out all over the neighborhood. You think he got popular in Philly? And the ensuing FBI investigation about the missing money was broadcast, and of course he was kind of just out there handing money out, so he thought, man, they might be able to find me. So Joey took off for the airport in Philadelphia, and he was caught a few days later trying to board, I don't know what city he was in, but he wasn't in Philly anymore, trying to board a flight to Mexico. And when they arrested him, his boots were stuffed with $105,000 in cash. I can't even imagine. He must have had boots up to his hips. And the jury, I mean, he was obviously arrested and charged, and the jury found him innocent of theft, okay, by reason of temporary insanity. Now, they did a movie on his life. That's John Cusack was in the movie there. I think I want to go see this. But they also wrote a book on his life called Finders Keepers. And he was asked, what was it like being an unemployed longshoreman to be unbelievably rich for a few days? It's the story we all would say, if only, right? Well, here's what Joey had to say in my best South Philly accent. I won't put nobody in my situation. Everybody's thinking they must have been great. Little do they know it was nothing but agony and despair. I must have aged in those 6 days 20 years. You have no idea what money does to you, especially that kind of money. And that is Solomon's point. That's the condensed version. You know, it doesn't work. Secondly, he says, besides what it does to us, it brings harm to our life. It brings harm. He says there's another serious problem, he says, he sees in the world here, besides just having the worries and the heartaches. He goes, sometimes it's hoarded. Money causes us to, we've got to keep it. I've got to hold it. We hoard it to the harm of the saver, or we put it into risky investments that turn south on us. You know, the people I know that fret the most about money are not poor people. That's not. It's always the people that have more money than I would ever think of having. I listen to people that are worried about money. I hear a lot of stories. And I think, well, I guess I'd like to have your financial problems. You know, liquidate. You're a stinking millionaire. But oh, no, it's just a fretting and worried all the time. In a story that was written several years ago about media mogul Ted Turner, who's still alive and well. And Ted has really done a remarkable job being a self-made millionaire. And I think he's the fourth richest man in America, even to this day. And he didn't come from money, although his father at one point was a millionaire. His father lost it all. But in this article, it talks about how Ted was expelled from Brown University, where after he went to work immediately in his father's billboard business. He got married in 1960, divorced when the first kid was on the way. 2 years later, married again. And by this time, his parents had divorced. His father had become a millionaire by the age of 50. However, when his business went down, his dad committed suicide. Very tragic for him. And the business was left to him. So Ted was told to sell what was left, and he said, no, I'm not going to sell it. And so he strategically built this empire back one block at a time until ultimately he made the millions in the media that he did from billboards. His second divorce ensued, but Ted never looked back, or so it seemed. But in the early 1980s, he was speaking, and he still does this to this day. He speaks on college campuses to the students. He was talking to 1,000 Georgetown University students. And Ted Turner, who even to this day is still kind of revered as this bulletproof, witty, I can't think of the word I want to use to describe him, but just different kind of a guy, you know. People kind of look up to him. And in the middle of this rip-roaring speech about entrepreneurship, Ted pulls out this well-worn copy of Success Magazine. And it was the journal. Success Magazine was the journal that his father used to read to him in the car on these long trips to inspect billboards. And on this particular copy, Ted's own face was on it. He's showing it to all the kids there. And then he said, the author of the article said, his booming voice trickled to a whisper. And he stared up into the rafters. And he said, is this good enough? Is this enough for you, Dad? See, I think Ted's father proved, if your love affair is with money, and it was for his father, you'll not have anything but money to leave your family. You can be likely assured of this. If all you're leaving, fathers, your children, is money and possessions, and you think that getting your kids all that you can get your kids and leaving your kids all that you can leave your kids is the best that you can do as a dad, you got it 180 degrees upside down. It is likely to hurt them more than it is to help them. Ted Turner is a man who makes a lot of money, and he makes witty jokes. Was he a good father? No. Was he a good husband? No. Do you have character in that regard? No. It doesn't work. And I just want to challenge you today, dads. You know, your kids, when they're small, they don't care how much money you make. They care how much time you spend with them. And that is the legacy you want to leave your children, is character, not money. Leave your kids character. Ecclesiastes 4:8, Solomon says, a man works hard to keep gaining more riches, and to whom will he leave it all? You're not going to get any points for wealth in heaven. You can't take any of it with you. You're going to leave it all here. In fact, there's a true story of a guy who was attending the funeral of another friend that was wealthy. And he says, I wonder how much he left behind. And somebody says, he left it all. Proverbs 23, again, something Solomon wrote. For riches can disappear as though they had the wings of a bird. Yeah, they can come and go pretty quick. And Solomon goes on to say, people who live only for wealth come to the end of their lives as naked and empty handed as of the day they were born. You know, he said, nothing that money buys leaves this world. You remember the Egyptian pharaohs would dump all that stuff into their tomb because they thought they could take it into the afterlife, but we all know what happened. What happened was tomb raiders took all that stuff. It didn't go with them, you know, and you raise your children in affluence without, and you say, well, I don't want to spoil them. I can't tell you how many dads I've heard over the years, you know, that were self-made men as far as, you know, their jobs. They went to work every day, blue collar. They got up, they bought a house, modest home. They did this, and what happened? You know, their homes were in a certain area, Southern California, and that area exploded with the population boom, and all of a sudden their house is worth all the money. But they're getting older, and they're starting to die, the builder generation, and all that money gets left to what? The baby boomer kids. And how many dads have I heard say, well, here's my sons, they don't have a clue how to work. And I want to go, whose fault was that? You know, and then you leave with a $1.2 million home. You know, and what does it do? Does it help them? No, it hurts them. Stockpiling wealth, giving it to the kids. Solomon left more than anybody else. You know, his son was Rehoboam. He was the biggest moral washout as a king, probably of all the kings of Judah. In fact, he was part of the whole splitting of the kingdom. Jeroboam and Rehoboam split Solomon's kingdom. Jeroboam was not Solomon's son, by the way, just Rehoboam was. But total washout. So, why more is never enough? Well, it's a heartache. We know that. It's also a hindrance to faith. He says wisdom or money can get you out of almost anything. But it's important to know that only wisdom can save your life. Jesus is the one who said in Matthew, I tell you the truth, it's very hard for a rich person to get into the kingdom of heaven. Now, why did he say that? Because money's evil? No, it's what we already talked about, because it competes for our attention. It preoccupies us. And here's the part I want you to hear this morning is, I think we come to church, we kind of go, yeah, I got my God thing going on here, you know. But God's just another box, just like all your other stuffs in life, because you really have something else going on that's competing for your attention. And when wealth or amassing wealth or possessions or living for the next trip or the next home or the next car or whatever is motivating you through the week, you're not thinking about your sin. You're not thinking about growing spiritually. You're thinking about those things. That's why Jesus said, none of us would say, oh, yeah, money's my God. No, we wouldn't say that, but that's how we're living. And Paul wrote to Timothy, the love of money is at the root of all kinds of evil, and some people craving it have wandered from the faith, pierced themselves with many sorrows. I mean, there's no lack of historical context of how the love of money has led people of all ages to destroy themselves and other people. In fact, I find it ironic that on our coins it says, in God we trust. Yet, it's probably money we trust far more than God in most instances of our life. It's right there on the stuff that we put our trust in. So, don't be eager for money, is what Solomon's trying to tell you and what Jesus is trying to tell you. So, I want to get to the real practical side as we wrap this morning. What does God want me to do with my money? How do I break the more is better? Okay, I think I can be satisfied. I know I can't. I mean, I hear I can't. And these things come to me, you know, these heartaches, these harm, these hindrances. So what does God want me to do with my money? Well, the first thing he wants you to understand is a principle of gratefulness in life. And this is the part that I want you to get this morning. The purpose of God speaking to you here today, not Dan. These are things you put to work in your life. This is what will break down the delusional barriers that you have created about what you think you need to be living for. Don't just come in here and spend an hour and 15 minutes with us and go out and then just go back to your life. That's the advantage of you being here, is that you can be awakened by God. He can speak to you this morning. And he's saying to you some things, three things here you're going to get real quick that are so important to how you choose to live. The first is be grateful. It's a good thing to receive wealth from God and the good health to enjoy it. No one's going to begrudge you that. To enjoy your work and accept your lot in life is indeed a gift from God. He goes on and he says, now look at this. This is a gift from God. He goes, but people who do this rarely look with sorrow on the past, for God has given them reasons for joy. People who do what? What does he mean? He says here, enjoy your work, accept your lot in life, that is indeed a gift from God, and people who do this rarely look with sorrow on their past. What does he mean? Do what? People who are content with what they have. Being grateful for what's already there. Look what he says later on in chapter 6. It's better to be satisfied with what you have than to always be wanting something else. This is really important. I didn't put it on a slide, but you can write it down. Financial freedom is not having enough money. If I put on multiple choice, that would be the 90% answer. Financial freedom, having enough money. If that was there for the answer, you'd pick, oh yeah, having enough money, that's financial freedom. You'll never have enough for all your wants. That's part of the fallen nature of man. Financial freedom is not having more money. It's having fewer wants. The wealthiest person in the world is the person who is happiest with the least amount. Friday, I was out with my girls training them, and on Fridays, I always give them a treat. We always go swimming in the lake right on the dock there at Valhalla, so we meet down there after a hard week of work. And I always look forward to it because the weather's been great the last month especially. And so we get there, and it hit me as I was walking out on the dock. You know, I had my running shoes on, my T-shirt, my shorts, and my bathing suit, and I got a towel. I just got my towel. Just me and my towel at the beach. And I'm going, how free am I? Just a towel, you know. And I go for a dip in the water. Now, as I'm walking down the dock and going for this dip, and I'm just loving splashing around. Oh, it's felt so good. In fact, I want to go right now. See ya. There's this beautiful wakeboard boat, just docked, just about 20 yards off the dock to the left. And there was two dads in it and a couple little guys in there. And they got all these nice wakeboards and they got the speakers. And, you know, I've seen this stuff. I used to own a boat myself for about 15 years. And so, boats can be fun. But I'm laughing because the whole time I'm in the water swimming, these guys are playing with a boat, fixing something, working on this, doing that. I'm thinking of Ross Perot's quote, the microwave must have gone out. And they're wiping things down. And sure, can you have fun on a boat? But you spend so much time with stuff that the simple thing in life of walking down on a dock with a towel wrapped around your neck, you know, Ford said, I just want my mechanic to say, I just want to take a dip in the lake. I'm in the water for 45 minutes. Swimming, you know, being a porpoise, coming out of the water. And I'm going, this water's great, shaking my head, you know, sitting on the dock, dangling my feet. I'm going, I don't have anything to fix. Where's my towel? Happy, learning to be content with what you have and the simple things in life. And we think, you know, once I reach that certain level of income, I'll be happy. No, you won't. So here's some things you need to remember. This is real important. It's God who gives you joy in life. Did you know that? It's not your things. It's God. Because if it were, the rich people would be the happiest people, and they're not happy. Just read the Inquirer and all the weird stuff going on in people's lives. You know, in the newspaper and all the gossip sheets and all the shows on television, these people are getting married and divorced and they're fighting and they're not happy. So how does God bring joy and happiness to our life? Well, we learn this in another lesson. He says, enjoy prosperity while you can, but when hard times strike, realize that both come from God. Underline that. Remember I said God's in the good and in the bad seasons of our life? Solomon taught us that. Why does God give us good and bad times? In order to gain perspective in this life. That's why. Unless you have bad times, you don't appreciate the good times as much. And God allows these in our lives because he wants us to what? Not just appreciate good times, but really to realize that anything good does come from him. And that really, that the only thing that matters in life is what we got going on here and here. And then when this gets established, this happens with everyone else. But if we get so focused on our money and our things and our possessions, these people are cut out, God's cut out, and we're not happy, so why do we do it? That's what Solomon's saying. Happiness isn't getting whatever you want, it's enjoying whatever you have. And the author of Hebrews said the same thing to us. Stay away from the love of money. Be satisfied with what you have. Which brings us to the most practical point of all this morning. Be generous. There's not one of you on your deathbed that's going to say, I wish I had been more of a tightwad. Words you'll never hear on your deathbed. Give generously, Solomon says. Your gifts will return to you later, you know. Paul says to Timothy, tell those who are rich in this world not to be proud, not to trust in their money. Does he say not to have the money? No, he said just don't be proud and to trust in it. And he's saying those their trust should be in God. Tell them to use their money to do good. Give generously to those in need. Always be ready to share with whatever God has. You know, and we're all rich. I've been in the third world. Do you know that if you own a home, you're in the top 3% in the world? If you own a car, you're in the top 6%? Unless it's a Pinot, and then you're in the top 25%. We live in this materialistic world, you know, and our culture is built on it. Awaken yourself, slap yourself in the face, go, I quit, I'm not doing it anymore. I don't care if I drive a 96 purple RAV, and I do. My wife does. I love driving that car just to see people. You know, it's like, you have no value. Good. You wouldn't go swimming with me anyway. That's the beauty of old age. Who cares if you like me? You know what? Be generous wherever you find yourself in life. Even if you're with a friend who's got money, buy them the Jamba Juice. Don't wait for them to buy it for you. And if they say, no, I got the money, don't rob me of the joy. And some of you I know are so poor, you don't have an extra 10 bucks a week to waste. I was there in my life at one time. And I'll tell you, I don't know where I heard this, but this is the best line in this sermon for me. If you've only got 10 bucks a week that you could waste on anything you want, spend 5 of them being generous. Give your life away. God says eternal rewards are going to be based on what you give away, not on how much you kept. And Jesus added it up. And he says, and when you give, do it in secret. Don't even let them know you're doing it. Just pull it off without anybody knowing what you're doing. That is storing for yourself treasures in heaven. Using what you have now for God's kingdom and purposes to bring joy and happiness to other people's lives. If you want to be happy, that's what happiness is. Share generously when people have a genuine need, not just because they stand there and say, hey, we'll work for a latte or whatever, you know. People who have a genuine need. Because God says, I'm watching. I'm watching. And I believe all of us intend to be generous. You know what the problem is? We never seem to be able to afford it. I just wish I had a few more bucks and then I'd be generous. I've heard that one before. In fact, I know people that were far more generous when they were poor than they are today when they have arrived financially. Because all of a sudden they have arrived financially and they start going, hey, you know what? I want to get this, I want to get this, I want to get this. Oh, yeah, now I need to get a little more, and then I'll go back and be generous again. You know, generosity is a lot like saving money. There's never a right time to save money. You always have to have a plan to save money. Well, you better have a plan to be generous. It won't happen. And lastly, be godly. This is the whole thing that Solomon ultimately comes down to. You know, at the end of his book, he says, you know what wisdom is? Fear God. Obey his commands. Because, you know, that's where you go someday. Jesus, as we said earlier, says you can't serve two masters. You can't say I'm loving and serving God and loving and serving money. You have to decide which is first in your life. And if you tell God, you know, God, I really want to make you first, he will test that because you can't serve two masters. Giving demonstrates what's first place in your life, my friends. If Jesus is the Lord of your life, he's going to be the Lord of your wallet. So before you go and get something once again for yourself or your family, stop and ask God, is this where I need to be? Is this right for my life? That's only your decision. No one here would ever question that choice you make or that answer. That's yours ultimately. Now, if you're a Christian, let me give you an example, and you know about tithing. It's the Old Testament principle of giving 10% of your income to the Lord, and you're not doing it, then you really haven't settled what's first place in your life. Well, actually, you have settled what's first place. And don't kid yourself, it's not God. You haven't settled the issue of what the master is and the master of your wallet is. Are you just, you know, are you going to do what God says for you to do that he clearly states in his word, or what you think you can afford to do, is what I tell people. God does not need your money. Ultimately, in some ways, Sierra Community Church doesn't need your money. You know what? Because I'm not here just to keep the system working at Sierra Community Church. You know, this thing all plugs because people stop supporting it. So be it. I'll go back and go to work someplace else, do whatever I have to do. God certainly doesn't need your money. He's not poor. He's not in welfare. Why does God ask his people to give 10%? I'll tell you why. He wants what it represents. Why? Because he tests you and he tests your character. What does it represent? It represents your heart. He said, I mean, you know, it really would have been Annie if God said, I'm going to give you 10% to live on. I want the other 90. But God says, you do what you want with the 90, but I want the first 10, is what he told the people of Israel. And he also went on, Jesus anteed that up and said, wherever your heart is, there you will find your treasure also. There you will find your treasure also. And you know, this is a convicting passage for me, because I know that my heart hasn't always been with God number one in my life. And if you're sitting here saying, I don't think money represents who I am, then why do you think you have such a hard time giving it away? It represents you. Trust me. So who's going to be your master? Faith will always require feet. You don't get to say, I love God, and have these little tiny feet that don't move. You know, I'm not going anywhere, but I love God. God says, get some size 12s and tromp for me. Walk with me. Do my thing. And remember this as we close right now. This great truth that Solomon wants you to grasp in life, this practical truth. He says, even so, I've noticed one thing at least that is good. Because he spent the first five chapters telling you what is wrong with life and all these pursuits and all these chasing of desires and doing all the things that Solomon could do like no one else has ever done it. And he says, they don't satisfy. He says, but I found one thing that's good. It's good for people to eat well, to drink a good glass of wine. For those of you that drink spinata, okay. And to enjoy their work, whatever you do. There's being a mechanic at the Ford plant instead of being the boss of the Ford plant. For however long God lets you live. It's taking it a day at a time. And go, wow, God, be generous, grateful. Real satisfaction is found in living and in doing, not in, I've got to get here, and I've got to get this, and amassing wealth. And it's possession. It doesn't work. Let's pray. Father, help us. Please help us. Help me to just to remove that barrier and that illusion and that wantonness and that driven desire, that indulgence that just says, oh, I want more satisfaction and this is how I'm going to get it. And Lord, and the whole time we're making that journey, we're missing everybody around us. And our marriages are crumbling and our children's relationship are crumbling because we're chasing stuff and possessions and things that don't mean anything, that don't last, and we don't get to take it with us to heaven. Lord, help us to ferret out those things that have lasting impact. Help our lives to reflect that in our choices. Lord, I'm just asking for an awakening that goes beyond what where our minds are at right now, that stays with us. And we truly look at what you've given us, and we're stewards of it in such a way that we can pay it forward to others' lives, bring glory to your name, receive the reward in heaven someday. We pray this in Jesus Christ's name. Amen. God bless you. God bless you. I love preaching to you guys.